Sussex, Wessex, Essex and East Anglia all seem like much more natural kingdoms to centre around Britannia's old Roman capital. Yet none of them cemented control over it while they had the chance. One of the reasons for this is that throughout the early Anglo-Saxon period, London, or Londinium, as the Romans called it, and they founded it, so it's actually quite offensive that we don't still call it that, was abandoned. I don't mean abandoned in the Sunday colour supplement sense of professional couples are abandoning the cities for a simpler life out of town. It wasn't a drift, a trend, a thing about house prices. Everybody left. Or died, which is a form of leaving. London, a large walled conurbation, was simply empty for nearly 200 years. It was used as nothing but the inspiration for baffled and mournful poetry. I know I've alluded to this abandonment before, but it's worth pausing to contemplate it for a moment. It's really strange. It means there was a complete cessation of one form of human occupation of that part of southern Britain and the start of a new one. The original Londoners died or fled to go and gradually become Welsh, and the newcomers looked at what they'd left behind, a city way beyond their technical abilities to construct, and thought, we don't want anything to do with that. They built hovels somewhere else instead and left London empty. I reckon that is weird. These are people who definitely wouldn't have taken the COVID vaccine. It's important to bear that in mind before we get too adulatory about the fact that a few of the knick-knacks found at Sutton Hoo came from Byzantium. The beginning of the repopulation of London came in 604 when Augustine appointed a man called Mellitus as Bishop of London and of the East Saxons, Essex, the kingdom that controlled the area at the time. Perhaps we could squeeze in its period of dominance soon after this. It only needs to be a few minutes. Mellitus had been sent from Rome and wasn't afraid of buildings, so he set up his church inside the city walls. By that time, a trading settlement, or wick, as they were called in Old English, had already built up, not inside the city walls, too scary, but just to the west, round about where the Strand and the Aldwych, or Old Wick, are now. This place was known as Lundenwick, and by the end of the 7th century, it was a major centre, for the same reasons that Rome and London had been, and the city has prospered to this day. It's a very good place to put a port. Once nominally under the aegis of the relatively feeble Kingdom of Essex, then tussled over by Kent and Wessex, by the early 8th century it was being run by the Mercians, whose king, Ethelbald, was making a fortune from the tolls he charged the traders. This powerful and prosperous situation continued to improve later in the century under the reign of Offa. As with most kings at this time, we know pitifully little about him. We have lots of unrealistic images of him on the many coins that were minted in his reign, another sign that greater stability and prosperity were being enjoyed than at any time since the Romans left. We also know he kept most other Anglo-Saxon kingdoms in subjection to him and built a fuck-off great big dike to say fuck-off to the Welsh. Plus, he corresponded with his illustrious contemporary Charlemagne, the dazzlingly successful European ruler who consolidated most of what is now France and a fair chunk of what is now Germany and Italy into one empire. Offa borrowed from Charlemagne the idea of having his son consecrated as king while he was still alive. This strategy was very fashion-forward. It was another part of the transmogrification of the office of king from top thug into something supposedly sacred and noble. Offa wanted his son Egfrith to be anointed and proclaimed his successor because this would add a sense of grandeur to the whole family and might obviate the period of savagery and chaos which was the usual consequence of a reign ending. That's what had happened between Ethelbald and Offa. The tricky aspect of Offa's plan was that such an anointing needed to be done by an archbishop, and there were only two in Anglo-Saxon England, one in York, part of the entirely independent Kingdom of Northumbria, and one in Canterbury in the Kingdom of Kent, which Offa had treated with considerable savagery. Neither archbishop was willing to oblige. So Offa persuaded the Pope to create a new archbishopric inside Mercia, the Archbishop of Lichfield. It was not an archdiocese destined for a great future, but it existed long enough to anoint Egfrith, which must have made Offa feel very secure about the future of his kingdom and his legacy. That's the feeling his reign gives. The brutality of Anglo-Saxon kingship is still there, but it's less chaotic, more organised, with an increasingly stable and well-funded infrastructure and a strengthening religious and ceremonial underpinning to the notion of kingship. Offa doesn't seem too different from the monarchs of centuries later, who were also corresponding with continental rulers, bargaining with the church, and nervously securing their son's succession. It's a much more relaxing picture. Perhaps history is going to be nice and normal from now on. Chapter 5. King Hell, it's the King Kings. Sometimes things just happen. That's worth bearing in mind. It's a great get-out clause if you're writing a history book. Look, it just happened, okay? I can always say. Sometimes things do. Never mind why. Deal with it. It simply occurred and that's that. Ask the scientists. They're up to their eyes in this stuff. Butterflies, wings and so on. Everything's just a chaos of microparticles. Things just happen. Don't get comfy. We're probably more than usually aware of this at time of writing, because the coronavirus pandemic was like that, all the jokes about bat-eating notwithstanding. And frankly, even if some bat-eating was contributory, I don't buy all that wise-after-the-event admonition. The whole, well, if you're going to eat bats, what do you expect attitude? Not this, is the answer to that. I expected a delicious bat meal, not a global pandemic. I maybe had half an eye on food poisoning. Perhaps that would have served me right. This is fucking insane. Now I'm talking as if I was the guy who ate the bat, which I'm not. I'm relatively confident I've never eaten bat, though I've had a fair few frozen lasagnas, so it's hard to be totally sure. From most of our points of view, the coronavirus pandemic was just a shit thing that suddenly happened, and not the inevitable consequence of the insufficient pandemic preparedness of governmental structures that incentivise using public money for easing politicians' paths to re-election rather than for stockpiling PPE or maintaining a vast, permanently mothballed emergency vaccine manufacture infrastructure. The pandemic might look inevitable in retrospect, but hardly anyone saw it coming. The monks at Lindisfarne, as they were being chopped to bits by some Vikings, probably told themselves they should have prayed more. I could tell you weren't concentrating at matins, Brother Edgar. Now look where we are. The thought that disasters are your fault is comforting on some level. It gives you the illusion of control when, in truth, something horrible came out of the blue and ruined your life. The Vikings were a thing that just happened, from most people's point of view. There weren't Vikings, or not as far as any non-Vikings knew, and then there were Vikings. Ships with ferocious dragon heads carved on their prows, crammed full of savage warriors, turning up and being horrible. It started in 793 at the holy island of Lindisfarne, just off the Northumbrian coast. A nice quiet spot for a monastery, everyone had thought 150 years earlier. Good for a bit of prayer. You can look at the sea, think about stuff, get away from it all. Then it all was abruptly redefined as gangs of scrappy pagans turning up in boats, hungry and broke. Lindisfarne became ground zero. It was a massive shock. I expect people hoped it wouldn't happen again. But it did. It kept happening. Just think of the stress, the mental health cost. It must have done people's heads in. Then a lot of those heads were also smashed in by Vikings. He wasn't as horny as I'd hoped. What I'm attempting here is empathy, popularised as a historian's tool by the GCSE syllabuses of the late 1980s. It falls down because it's impossible for a child living in late 20th century Britain to get their head round how different the lives of the people they're trying to empathise with actually were. They haven't got much better at it by the time they've become, say, early 21st century comedians or... Well, I can't really imagine what else they might have become. As I say, empathy's tricky. But we need to focus more on it and less on dates. That was the thinking among the GCSE boffins. I'm better with dates, to be honest. So, 793 to 1066. That's the era of the Vikings. It's quite precisely defined for something so anarchic, like a rugby match. Why are they so susceptible to the whistle, I sometimes think. It's basically a fight. Well, the final whistle in the match between the Vikings and the rest of the world... Well, not the whole rest of the world. They didn't get to China, but they got to North America and Russia and Constantinople. ...was blown in 1066. Who won? It's not clear. It was sort of a draw. There were Vikings everywhere, but most of them had become Christians, which, for a lot of the non-Vikings, was the point of everything. But everyone was very tired and cold and wet, and had long since given up on relaxing at the seaside. I don't mean to imply, by the way, that the Vikings aren't fun. This is the problem with all the empathy. One can easily end up focusing exclusively on what it was like being a Viking. Cold, scary, damp, desperate, navigational excellence worn lightly. Or meeting one. Jesus saved me from the arsehole with the axe. when for the vast majority of humanity, and absolutely everyone listening to this book, that's not the main thing at all. They were brilliant, unless you met them personally, in which case they were awful. Bit like Peter Sellers. From our point of view, the Vikings had great big boats and beards and gods, and they smashed things up and travelled everywhere and had horns on their helmets. They didn't have horns on their helmets. That might have been the first thing a teacher ever told me about the Vikings. As far as I recall, the order of events for me was 1. Not having ever heard of any people called the Vikings. 2. A teacher said, "Here is a picture of some Vikings," and showed me an illustration of some amazing warriors in a dragon boat with horns on their helmets. 3. The teacher said they didn't really have horns on their helmets. The fact that history remained my favourite subject despite that moment is a real testament to how boring the other lessons were. I don't know where the idea of Vikings having horns on their helmets came from, but it's a brilliant one. In every possible way, other than the literal truth, they totally had horns on their helmets. Horned helmets was absolutely their vibe, and I feel we all have a right to that deeper artistic truth. They had limited technology, and manufacturing helmets was pretty tricky for them, I imagine, so putting horns on them wouldn't have been workable and wouldn't have increased the functionality of the helmets, but I swear they'd have given it a go if they'd thought of it. We can't know, though. Maybe they'd have given them peaks like baseball caps, or warming ear flaps, or a single prong like the Prussians. We don't know that much about them, except how stressful it was to meet them, because they didn't write stuff down, so we don't have much sense of their point of view. They came from Scandinavia, but nobody knows why they came, and, conversely, before the late 8th century, nobody knows why they didn't. It's another mists of time thing, once again evocatively supplemented by imagining people literally emerging out of mists. Although the Vikings are likely to have preferred sunny weather for their inexplicable arrivals. I mean, you can speculate about why they came if you want to, if you really hate yourself and can't stand a bit of mystery in your life. You can start thinking about their reasoning and ferreting around for the evidence. But I think it's a bit of a shame, rather George Lucas of you. You've got some horned warriors in dragon ships emerging enigmatically from the mist. Why ruin it with the prequel? Why start asking, ooh, what happened before this dramatic bit? What dry socio-economic causes can we root out? Need I say I am not a professional historian? I suspect that the view, it's more fun to keep a bit of mystique about what's actually going on, is frowned upon in academic circles. In the case of the Vikings, the joyless search has gone largely unrewarded because nobody's sure. Their Scandinavian lands were getting crowded and fractious is one reason, as you'd probably have guessed. We don't totally know. Personally, I'm going to side with the atheists and blame Thor. He sounds like a very problematic role model. All is lost but the irony. The Vikings made their presence felt all over Europe and gave the Franks, the Irish and the Picts just as much shit as they did the Anglo-Saxons. Still, for the Anglo-Saxons there was an irony about the Vikings' arrival that there wasn't for any of the other peoples being harassed. The Vikings were doing almost exactly what the Anglo-Saxons themselves had done 300 or 400 years earlier, turning up in boats, all savage and pagan and fighty, and nicking stuff. Newly Christianised as they were, the Anglo-Saxons had retrospectively justified their success over the Britons in terms of the latter's decadence or sin. It was the will of God that they should have conquered Britannia, even if it was a god they didn't believe in at the time they did the conquering. Now the tables were turned. The Anglo-Saxons were the Christian residents facing pagan invaders, and once again, God seemed to be favouring the infidel newcomers. In the early 9th century, the giant geographical backwards clock showing the dominant Anglo-Saxon kingdom had done its last mega-tick and moved on from Mercia to Wessex. This change was precipitated by the Battle of Ellendun in 825, when Egbert, King of Wessex from 802 to 838, had defeated King Beornwulf of Mercia. Despite Offa's careful succession planning, Beornwulf was not descended from him, but had nicked the throne off another king who was also not descended from him. So the Archdiocese of Lichfield was all a colossal waste of energy, and in fact had already been abolished. Ellendun was the culmination of Beornwulf's invasion of Wessex, and his defeat indicated a major shift of power to Egbert. By 830, Egbert was acknowledged as Bretwalder and was either directly in control of, or had been acknowledged as a senior king, by all the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. Sadly for Egbert, though, it wasn't possible to enjoy it. This early 9th century squabbling between the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms is reminiscent of the way the BBC and ITV still tussle to win the Saturday night TV ratings war. Like Wessex and Mercia in the 820s, they must find something comforting in that old, irrelevant conflict. It distracts them from the terrifying new threats they're facing. For King Egbert, the equivalent of YouTube, Netflix, Amazon and the Conservative Party was the Vikings. The raiding and killing and stealing from anywhere coastal went on throughout the early 9th century, and while there were periods of respite, usually when the focus of Scandinavian raids moved to Francia or Ireland, the trend was steadily worsening. More depressing still, the Vikings' range gradually extended inland. Many of the Roman-walled towns were reoccupied by Anglo-Saxons, who were now, like their Briton predecessors, more inclined to agoraphobia than claustrophobia. The Anglo-Saxon response was a confused mixture of fighting back and trying to buy the Vikings off. Neither strategy worked. All military victories over the Vikings were temporary. More of them would pop up again, streaming from coasts and navigable rivers. And the Anglo-Saxons wouldn't have needed us to explain why bribing Vikings to go away was a counterproductive strategy over anything but the very, very short term. Every time they did it, the cocktail of desperation and self-loathing must have been a bitter draught, particularly for a populace accustomed to mead, which is quite sugary. It's easy to criticise the Anglo-Saxons for this response because it failed. But the tide was against them, literally and metaphorically. The Vikings were masters of the sea and ferocious fighters on land, and the Anglo-Saxons must have felt that they were being punished by God for something. Let's be honest, there were plenty of things to choose from. There's all the murder, of course, but also they were really sexist. This formless guilt must have further sapped morale. What if they were as contemptible to the Almighty as those loser Britons about whom they were accustomed to feeling so contemptuous? Fundamentally, though, the technology and martial practices of the time hugely favoured offensive action. It's not that the raiders were necessarily better at fighting, it's that raiding was easier than repelling raiders. Militarily speaking, the Anglo-Saxons were attempting the early medieval equivalent of reversing a blitzkrieg offensive without air cover. They were fucked. Chapter 6. King Alfred the Great. Then, in 865, they were saved. From the chapter heading, you might assume that the accession of King Alfred had something to do with it. Not really. That didn't happen until 871. What happened in 865 was that the Vikings decided to take over all of England permanently. They'd moved on from nicking movables, now they wanted real estate, somewhere to settle down. Why did that help the Anglo-Saxons? In the short term, it didn't. It was an absolute disaster, seemingly. First Northumbria, then East Anglia, then most of Mercia were conquered, leaving a small puppet-ruled western rump. Edmund, the last independent king of East Anglia, was killed in battle by the Vikings in 869, and rumours of the brutality of his treatment were such that he was soon venerated as a Christian martyr. The story goes that the Vikings tied Edmund to a tree and insulted him and beat him and fired arrows and spears at him while he refused to renounce his Christianity. So finally they chopped his head off and threw it deep into the forest, where his followers went looking for it. The head called out to them, and they found it being guarded by a wolf, who, out of respect, was not eating it. They then popped it back on the body, and it became miraculously reattached. There are many issues with this account. Why were these followers allowed to stroll about in the wake of a Viking victory? What the fuck had they been doing when King Edmund was trying to win a battle? Why did the victorious Vikings give a damn whether Edmund renounced his faith? How can we be sure that the wolf wasn't just pausing to work out how to eat a king's head without breaking a tooth? In fact, the disembodied talking head seems like the most plausible element. And as miracles go, reattaching a head to a dead body is pretty lame. What's the use of that? You wouldn't last long in the Marvel universe with that superpower. At some point in the next century or so, Edmund's remains were interred in a place that, but for the last S, was named after precisely what people first went there to do. Bury St. Edmund's. Another saint king whose admirers focused on his celestial title. I suppose calling a town Bury King Edmund's would have sounded like incitement to insurrection, which, if you've ever been there, you'll know is not the vibe of the place at all. Catastrophic though this all sounds, in the long run, it saved the Anglo-Saxons. Now both they and the Vikings wanted the same thing, to take large areas over and retain control of them. It was a fair fight. trying to defend everything and everyone from tens of thousands of seaborne raiders who could strike anywhere and leave just as quickly was, a cool 1,070 years before the invention of radar, impossible. You can't defend everything at once from people who possess nothing that you can attack. As soon as the Vikings started trying to occupy areas of the country, however, the Anglo-Saxons had a chance. Still, when someone is repeatedly stamping on your face, it takes a while to realise that what you're being smashed with is their Achilles heel. Everything seemed to be getting more ominous. Then, in 870, the great Viking army turned its attention to the last and most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdom, Wessex. That thing on your knob looks wrong. When I was 10, the history teacher informed us that we were going on a school trip to see the Alfred Jewel. This announcement, which would have confused me as an adult, was taken by the whole class in our world-weary strides. We were used to baffling stuff. Having to absorb weird thing after weird thing after weird thing is what being at school largely consists of. Whatever the empathy drive in history teaching, no adult, however great a teacher, not even Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society himself, can quite get their heads round the extent to which small children don't have the first idea what's going on. Where do you start? With my own daughter, I quickly realised that my instinct to explain the United Nations and then cover the structure of global human interaction downwards from there had to be resisted. We may as well start with animal noises, even though, in adult life, they hardly ever come up. It's the only trip to see a jewel I've ever been on, but at the time I didn't know that grown-up life wasn't full of jewel-seeing trips, or indeed that the world wasn't packed with jewels named after men. For all I knew, that's what tourism mainly was. Let's go down to Worthing at the weekend and have a good look at the Eric, Steve and Keith jewels. I enjoyed the trip very much, partly because my expectations had been skillfully managed. I was only expecting to see one jewel, but I also got to walk through a museum containing other artefacts on the way and through the far greater wonders of the gift shop on the way out. And partly because the Alfred jewel is a very nice thing to look at. It's not really a jewel, it's a piece of jewellery. It's made of filigreed gold, which looks exactly as it sounds, all twiddly and intricate, is about 6 centimetres long and seems to have been made to put on the end of a stick, like a sort of knob. I don't know why they didn't call it the Alfred knob. It was discovered in Somerset in 1693 by people who didn't even realise they were living in the past themselves. It was assumed, probably correctly, that it was made for King Alfred the Great, because it has the phrase, "Alfred ordered me made," written around it in Old English. It's from the late 9th century and is powerful anecdotal evidence that the Dark Ages were over, though nobody seemed to be able to draw a face that looked realistic at any point between the Romans leaving and the Tudors. Does thinking that make me a Philistine? There's a picture on the Alfred jewel, in the middle of all the lovely gold work, that archaeologists think is supposed to be Jesus. Nobody knows what Jesus really looked like, but we can be pretty sure he didn't look like that. It's skillfully crafted in enamel under quartz, but the image itself is like something I might have done while drunkenly playing online Pictionary on my phone. Maybe it's all equally valid, but I believe the thing with modern art is that it isn't supposed to look real, but the artists could do it Michelangelo's standard if they wanted. Picasso puts the ears on the same side of the nose, but it's deliberate, and he could totally have turned a profit doing funny caricatures for tourists in Montmartre if he'd needed the money. I don't reckon that holds with medieval art. I reckon they wanted it to look as good as a photo, but they couldn't get it right. The craftsmanship's there, the Anglo-Saxon jewellery, and then all the cathedral building, but no one can draw. The original owner of the jewel, King Alfred of Wessex, known as Alfred the Great, is a very famous king indeed, certainly the most famous to be covered in this book so far, apart from King Arthur. That's largely because, unlike any other Anglo-Saxon ruler, a biography was written about him during his lifetime and, with a little bit of chopping and changing and a few random additions, it has survived to this day. It was written by a monk called Asser, and it's very much an authorised biography, overwhelmingly positive. It says Alfred was, well, great. Capable and clever and wise and kind and nice and terrific at battles and admin, and that's basically the view of Alfred that's come down to us. Though latterly it has been questioned by the bloody let's try and work out what actually happened killjoys fresh from lopping Viking horns off. While we're on that subject, I should mention that the Vikings weren't called Vikings at the time. It's not clear where the term Viking came from. There are a tedious number of competing theories, but it's very clear what it means now, and for that reason, I think it's a good word. Nevertheless, the terms in use at the time were, among others, Norse, Northmen, Norsemen, or Danes, whether or not they originated from what we'd now call Denmark. I'm going to start using those names too, mainly when I don't want you to think of them as having horns on their helmets. The trouble with the imagined picture of them with the horns is that it looks like a stag do, which is a bit negative and trivialising for something so geopolitical, particularly once, as is about to happen, they start converting to Christianity. That would be a weird vibe for a stag do. That's when the penny drops that the beatifically smiling best man, who seems like such a lovely guy, is a Mormon. It made a great story. The fact that the Danes converted to Christianity was thanks in part to the efforts of Alfred. The youngest grandson of King Egbert, he became king in 871. His three elder brothers had all been kings before him and had brief, stressful reigns. At the point of his accession, the situation was terrible. A huge Danish army was roaming the south of England, winning more battles than it lost, and all the other Anglo-Saxon kingdoms had been overthrown. By early 878, things had deteriorated further. Wessex was almost entirely taken over by the Danes, and Alfred was reduced to hiding in the Somerset Levels, a harder place to hide than somewhere more undulating. I mean, anyone can hide in the Alps. The Danes must have been surveying the horizon for suspicious Alfred the Great-sized pieces of cover, like in that Monty Python sketch, How Not to Be Seen. Alfred came back from that low point of marshy guerrilla warfare, won the Battle of Edington in May 878 against the army of Guthrum the Dane, the new Viking of East Anglia, made Guthrum convert to Christianity, reorganised the military, founded a navy, issued a law code, and established himself as ruler of all of England, southwest of a line drawn from where Essex meets the Thames up to the top right-hand corner of Wales. The other half was known as the Danelaw. Alfred was established as the preeminent Anglo-Saxon. It was quite a dramatic turnaround. At some point he also had a duel made. Is all that enough for him to be known as the Great? Demonstrably it is. Still, it's not quite Napoleonic. It's more the regal equivalent of rescuing the fortunes of a struggling regional chain of family-owned shoe shops. If great monarchs have parties in the afterlife, I reckon Catherine of Russia and Alexander of Macedon are going to be raising their eyebrows behind Alfred's back in the same way St. Peter and St. Mary Magdalene do when St. Edward the Confessor walks into the reception for saints and starts troughing on the special canapes reserved for martyrs. These mediocre Brits get everywhere. I remember being told at school that Alfred was the only British king who's called the Great. The 9th century seemed quite early for British history to have peaked. The best king over with before the proper numbering system even started. Let's not forget that if Prince William's grandson is named Alfred, he'd become King Alfred I. There's no infiltrating Wantage's greatest son into the official post-conquest numbering system, no matter how good he was at sneaking about in a bog. It's impossible to know how great Alfred really was, but he got a lot of things right. His decision to call upon the defeated Danes to convert and to make Guthrum his own godson is clever. On the face of it, it looks like either an act of open-handed Christian clemency by a deeply religious man, or an aggressive and humiliating move to take away your foe's religion and culture. It's neither, really. It's opening up diplomatic relations. It's establishing a situation of mutual acknowledgement, maybe even respect. OK, we're both going to live on this island, and we have to make that work somehow, is the key message. Another message. Forget about Mercia. Alfred styled himself King of the Anglo-Saxons. The ruler of the Rump of Mercia, not under the Danelaw, a nobleman called Ethelred, acknowledged Alfred's lordship and never styled himself king. Alfred frequently used the word Angelcun, the English race. He pushed the idea of Englishness and an Anglo-Saxon kingdom in vague opposition not merely to the Britons, but also to the Danes. The remaining Anglo-Saxon bits of the island were coalescing into a coherent political entity led by the House of Wessex. Alfred's greatest achievement, however, was his posthumous PR. Maybe we should really be talking about Asser the Great. Like King Arthur, King Alfred later became a convenient repository for English patriotic feeling, and unlike King Arthur, he both definitely existed and isn't also a convenient repository for Welsh patriotic feeling. Some patriots can get really pissy about sharing the convenient repositories for their feelings, which is why it's a bad idea to tell a football hooligan that St. George was from Turkey. An English football hooligan, that is. I don't suppose any other sort of football hooligan, even a Turkish one, gives a damn where St. George was from. Alfred's and Asser's efforts to lay down the basis for a nice positive Wikipedia page were useful to posterity. Alfred, said Asser, was English, pious, learned and militarily successful, so an obvious figure to want to associate yourself or your country with. This positivity developed a momentum that lifted Alfred above all the other Anglo-Saxon kings and meant random achievements were attributed to him, like aphorisms to Winston Churchill. For example, in the 14th century, the idea got round that he'd founded University College Oxford, which is roughly as historically plausible as Mozart designing the iPhone. In the 15th century, Henry VI tried to have him made a saint, but he failed, which then counterintuitively gave Alfred's reputation a massive boost after the English Reformation, because unlike other celebrated Anglo-Saxon monarchs, St. Ceolwulf of Northumbria, St. Edmund of East Anglia, and St. Edward the Confessor, he wasn't tarred with the papist sainting brush. Protestants were able to infer that Alfred's Christianity had been more English and less Roman, and was therefore a precedent for Anglicanism. Needless to say, this was bullshit. In the comforting story of English history that the Victorians liked to tell, a great king like Alfred, who they could assert was properly English, even though the term was only emerging in his day, defeating and converting the Danes, and then sorting out his kingdom with some sensible laws and a nice fleet, feels like a perfect starting point for a long and glorious narrative, with a few ups and downs to keep it interesting, but lots more ups than downs, leading with messianic inevitability to a lovely great big empire. There were huge celebrations around the 1000th anniversary of Alfred's death in 1899, with an enormous statue of him commissioned for the city of Winchester, which was unveiled 2 years later at an event so massive and exciting that it was reported in the New York Times and Lord Rosebery came to speak. Yes, Lord Rosebery! Lord Rosebery had briefly and unsuccessfully been Prime Minister. Not as briefly or unsuccessfully as Liz Truss, more at the Theresa May level. Still, I think we have to accept that the prospect of a speech from him was more of a draw in 1901 than the prospect of one from May is today. Thank the Lord for TV. Alfred's reign rivals 1066 as a beginning, because there's no avoiding the fact that William the Conqueror seems a bit French. Alfred, meanwhile, if he weren't entirely English, might have been, as an Anglo-Saxon, a tiny bit German. A very useful attribute during periods such as the 18th and 19th centuries, when the contemporary British royal family weren't quite as un-German as could be wished. History never stops. The trouble with the Alfred beginning is that in terms of that Victorian narrative, leading to a nice organised England with the lions and the longbows, and then a nice organised Britain with the empire and the gunboats, it's a bit of a false dawn. That gets in the way of the story the British in the late 19th century were trying to tell. From their point of view, it's obvious where the whole English and British thing is heading. It's towards everyone on the island of Great Britain being in the same country, very happy about that, ruling much of the world, and in general being very rich and right about things. That's how it must have felt to most British people who took an interest in the past around about 1900. There's an impatience in telling the history to get it all going. Never mind all the tribes and mini-kingdoms, the Picts and the Scots, the Danes and the Norse. We all know where this is heading. Get on with it. Looking at things an eventful 1.2 centuries later, that majestic narrative arc has got a bit chewed at the end. There's no longer any sense that British power was for the best. Plus, most of it's gone. The sense of a Britain run from London, an effective enlargement of the former Kingdom of England, as definitely the way events were always heading and would inevitably end up, has evaporated even while the UK remains nominally intact. These days it's possible for us to contemplate the confusing events between the death of Alfred the Great and the arrival of William the Conqueror without getting distracted by the prospect of a nice British imperial happy ending, because we know about the Somme and the Blitz and Suez and Profumo and the miners' strike and Brexit and Covid. We can understand more clearly that history isn't actually a proper story. It's more like a soap opera. It never fucking ends. So it has to get cyclical. England comes together, and then something has to happen next, and one of the options that the exhausted cosmic hack writers might go for is England falls apart again. The same goes for Britain. Together, apart, united, divided. You wait till we get to all the attempts by kings of England to be in charge of France. It's so repetitive. Raising an army, getting it there, fighting, might go well, might not, again and again and again. Cut a long history short, they never really get to be in charge of France. But they keep trying. Maybe it's not a soap, maybe it's a sitcom. This time next year, my son, we'll be kings of France. They even said they were kings of France for 460 years. In general, people who say they're kings of France but clearly aren't get sectioned. But if you happen genuinely to be king of England, you seem to get away with it. Ironically, it was George III, who did go mad, who finally dropped the delusional claim. At the end of Alfred's reign, then, the situation for the Anglo-Saxons was much better than it had been at the beginning, but that wasn't saying much. And when I say much better, I'm ignoring the main thing that hadn't changed at all, the fact that almost all of them were medieval peasants. Whoever happens to be king, that is a horrible thing to be. There was astronomical infant mortality, a 20% death rate of mothers in childbirth, and, if neither of those things got you, a grim life of toil and shortage. Still, for the minority of Anglo-Saxons affluent enough to care, here was the state of play. Half of them were still under Viking rule in the vast Dane law, and there still wasn't anything like a proper Kingdom of England, whatever posterity reckoned. Alfred ruled most of the rest of the Anglo-Saxon area, an enlarged and stabilised Wessex, encompassing the southwestern half of Mercia, plus Kent, Sussex and London, though there was still a small surviving fragment of non-Wessexian, non-Wessexy, non-Wessexual, a-Wessexual, Anglo-Saxon rule in the northern section of the old Kingdom of Northumbria, the bit we still call Northumbria today. Don't feel bad that England still didn't exist. France didn't either. But again, it's on the way. In 843, at the Treaty of Verdun, Charlemagne's grandsons agreed to split his vast empire into East Francia, which evolved into a state that, broadly speaking, was the precursor of Germany, and West Francia, which later started to be referred to as France. It's eerily appropriate that 1,073 years later, Verdun was also the location chosen for Germany and France to fight a vast and fruitless nine-month battle of apocalyptic mechanised slaughter that still somehow failed to jolt them into a lasting peace. At the time of the treaty, Verdun itself went to neither of the Francias, but to the third and thinnest slice of the imperial cake, called Lotharingia, which was squeezed between the other two and didn't last long for that reason. In the late 9th century, the kings of West Francia were having their own issues with Vikings or Northmen. One of them, Rollo, had invaded and occupied the area around Rouen and, in 885, had nearly taken Paris. But, like Alfred, the West Francian ruler Charles III had accepted the new reality. In 911, in exchange for agreeing to be baptised, marrying Charles's daughter Gisela, and leaving the rest of the kingdom alone, Rollo and his heirs were granted authority under the West Francian crown to all the land between the river Ept and the sea. Since it was now ruled by these Northmen, or Normans, the region became known as Normandy. Chapter 7. Kings Edward, Athelstan, Edmund, Eadred, Eadwy, Edgar, and another Edward, and Queen Ethelflaed. Two things are striking about the names of Alfred's successors and the notables of their courts. First, the similarity. So many Elfs, Alfs, Eds, Ads, and Ethels that we're forced to conclude that the Anglo-Saxons found making those noises a lot easier than people do now. They're quite tricky syllables, if you ask me, but maybe in an age of, by our standards, catastrophically poor dental hygiene, Ethels and Adwys tripped off the tongue comparatively easily. Perhaps it was a noise that came naturally and five or six would just slip out, accompanied by gloops of saliva, as a side effect of working a particularly fibrous chunk of turnip round to the last fully functioning molar. And second, half of them survive as common modern names, while the other half looked like a piece of software had those names typed into it and then generated the rest. On the one hand, there's the likes of Alfred, Edward, Edgar and Edmund. Okay, fine. And on the other, Alfward, Athelstan, Ethelred, Eadred, Eadwy and Ethelflaed. Bless you. There'll eventually be an England. This period, the early to mid-10th century, is when the Kingdom of England started. It feels like it deserved a bit more fanfare. The truth is, it was something of a soft launch. When Alfred died in 899, the next king, his eldest son, was called Edward, known as Edward the Elder by historians, to distinguish him from another King Edward, who briefly reigned later in the century, and another one in the century after that. As discussed earlier, this is all long before King Edward I, who didn't reign until the late 13th century and was therefore in reality the fourth. This means Edward VIII was really Edward XI, which, for reasons I can't quite put my finger on, seems more appropriate for a Nazi sympathiser. On accession, Edward was challenged for the throne by his cousin Ethelwold, a great name for an artisanal cheese, who was the son of Alfred's elder brother and predecessor as king. This kind of crisis happened more often than not between reigns. The tradition King Offa had tried to start, of getting the next king anointed during the reign of the current one, had failed to catch on amid all the Viking stress. When you're surrounded by death, the last thing you want to think about is death. That's why the troops at the Somme must have been reluctant to discuss estate planning. They say history is written by the victors, and they're right, whoever they are, which is probably why what little we know about Ethelwold makes him seem like a wanker. He rebelled against Edward, forcibly married a nun, holed up at the place where his father was buried, Wimborne, to be precise, swore he'd die rather than leave there, and this was long before they had a model village, then did in fact leave there without dying, reason prevailed, but also without taking his poor wife, the nun, with him. What a wanker! His next move was more impressive. He fled to the Danish kingdom of Northumbria, which was where Yorkshire is now, to the south of the surviving rump of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria, which, as I've said, was where Northumbria is now, and persuaded its leaders to make him king. Nobody knows how. Maybe he wasn't such a wanker. Or maybe the Vikings liked wankers. Either way, he invaded Mercia with a Danish army, did all the usual damage, and then retreated into East Anglia. Edward followed him there with his own army to do some retaliatory smashing and grabbing, but left without managing a proper battle. The proper battle happened soon afterwards, in 902, between Ethelwold's Danes and a force of Kentish men who refused Edward's repeated orders to stop pillaging and come home. It was called the Battle of the Home, and Ethelwold was killed at it. End of succession crisis. Still, the Danish presence in what is now England was considerable. There was an East Anglian Danish kingdom, plus a large area in the East Midlands called the Five Boroughs. It centred on the towns of Leicester, Nottingham, Stamford, Derby and Lincoln, ruled by a coalition of Viking warlords, as well as the other Danish kingdom around York. Ethelwold's antics showed that these Vikings were very much still in the market for attacking, looting and otherwise destabilising the kingdom of the Anglo-Saxons. During Edward's reign, this situation shifted and the power of the House of Wessex was extended considerably. He was supported in this by his formidable elder sister Ethelflad, known as the Lady of the Mercians. She was married to Ethelred, the non-king of the non-Danelaw bit of Mercia whom I mentioned earlier. He died in 911 but was in poor health for some years before that, which meant that for over a decade before her own death in 918, Ethelflad was running the place and orchestrating military activity that relentlessly encroached upon the Danelaw. In the chapter heading, I've referred to Ethelflad as a queen, which isn't strictly true. But as the daughter and sister of kings and the effective ruler of an Anglo-Saxon kingdom, she deserves the title, tonally speaking. Also, I'm bitterly aware that this is the first mention of a woman in this narrative, apart from a brief one for Queen Bertha of Kent and an adjectival contribution from Queen Victoria. And actually, I think my daughter got a nod, but that's really just nepotism, as her impact on early medieval English history is tiny. I'm sorry about that. It is one of the boring things about a lot of history. The towering sexism of many ages and of many subsequent ages which have spearheaded the analysis of those earlier ages has left the specifics of all the brilliant or shitty things women were doing largely unrecorded. You'd think that all they were doing was marrying kings, which the overwhelming majority were not. I'm acknowledging this because I'm aware of the irony that while I'm writing about an age in which almost all women and men were illiterate, in the current era of mass literacy, it is much more likely that any given book is being read by a woman than by a man. Men read less than women and instead commit more violent crime and listen to more audiobooks. These aren't necessarily the same men, I should add. Back in the 10th century, after the death of Ethelflad, the violence is once again almost exclusively being committed by men. By the end of Edward's reign, he had taken over East Anglia and four of the five boroughs. Only Lincoln and the kingdom centering around York were still in Viking hands. The Might of Rome. This trend continued apace under the next king, Athelstan, who, after the traditional succession crisis, culminating in the suspicious death of his half-brothers, mopped up the rest of the Danelaw. After 927, he styled himself, in his various charters, as Rex Anglorum, King of the English, rather than merely of the Anglo-Saxons. Better still, his military dominance was such that he was able to assert a sort of pseudo-imperial superiority over the whole of Britain, with grudging endorsement from the various Scottish, Welsh, or Danish rulers. He had sufficient clout to make them all assemble at councils to acknowledge his seniority, which caused a lot of bad feeling, similar to that felt by the leader of the SNP whenever they're caught in traffic on the M25. These resentments turned to rebellion, culminating in the brutal Battle of Brunanburh, in which the Anglo-Saxons, led by Athelstan, defeated the combined forces of the kings of Scotland, Strathclyde, and Dublin. The kings of Wales had wisely decided to suppress their disgruntlement and not take part. Athelstan carried all before him, declaring himself the Rex Totius Britanniae, which you don't have to be much of a classical scholar to translate. It sounds like joke Latin made up by a child, something like Imperius Completus Everywarium or Bossus Worldii Massivum. There's something infantile about these post-Dark Age rulers' relationship with Rome. They seem to have only the sketchiest idea of what the Roman Empire actually was, but a strong sense that it was enormous and official, and that the route to looking like you're allowed to be in charge of stuff was via affecting to be extremely Roman. It's a bit like some nursery school children trying to dress up as astronauts. There's lots of glue and glitter, but it's all a bit crumpled. The whole business of having crowns was borrowed from the later Roman emperor's habit of wearing diadems. The objects were then infused with some handy religious significance when the Eastern Romans invented coronations based on some biblical references to crowns and anointing. What looks to us like an archetypically medieval ceremony caught on across Europe because of its associations with the mystique of classical antiquity, this ancient pagan superpower that was also somehow where Christianity came from. Then Charlemagne decided he was going to have a bit of that. He had the brilliant idea of announcing he was the Roman Emperor, or, as the office was later referred to with garish hyperbole, Holy Roman Emperor. What is it, boy wonder? Since the original proper Roman Empire had split in half in the 4th century, the eastern bit had been going pretty strong, but the western half hadn't, see above, and the title of Western Emperor had lapsed. So having put together an extremely large early medieval kingdom, albeit still much smaller than the western half of the Roman Empire had once been, Charlemagne twigged that a key part of becoming an emperor was saying you were one. There's a pleasing irony to this. The first actual Roman emperors, you know, the proper ones like Augustus and Tiberius and Nero, when Rome was all-conquering and the whole notion of its decline was restricted to its own self-involved literature, always pretended not to be emperors. They still went along with the notion that Rome was a republic run by elected consuls, sometimes not troubling to become consuls themselves. In fact, the term emperor started as a euphemism. Rome, having become a republic, loathed the notion of kings. Emperor derived from imperator, which means a military commander. They weren't horrible kings, just trusty commanders, in the same way that Stalin was just a nice, reliable general secretary, rather than anything showy or threatening like a president or czar. A few baffled centuries later, the concept of a king had been detoxified, but the concept of an emperor, having been conceived to say, "Don't worry, I'm not a king or anything threatening like that," had come to mean, "I'm a king among kings, full of the might and legitimacy of Rome, whatever that was." Alfred and his grandson Athelstan loved all this. Alfred had actually been to Rome as a boy on two occasions, which, considering it was then a 2 or 3 month journey each way, will have taken up quite a lot of his childhood. While there, the Pope had given him a cingulum, a sort of utility belt that officers in the Roman army wore, and the robes of a consul. Imagining this scene of a Pope in 9th century Rome, a feeble and impoverished city lurking on the outskirts of the ruins of its namesake empire's mega-capital, handing out shiny bits of old Roman clobber to random visiting children, is both poignant and hilarious. These items were then ceremonially handed on to Athelstan by Alfred. With how much understanding of the vast difference between the Anglo-Saxon system of government and that presided over for centuries by the polytheistic consuls of Rome, we can't know. Athelstan was the first English king who, at his consecration in Kingston in 925, had a crown placed on his head rather than the traditional helmet. This piece of Byzantine ceremonial had taken 500 years to reach England, almost as slow as the espresso machine, and was the first of many English coronations. It's a moment of childish blinging up that we're still stuck with, a vulgarity as irreversible as when they started putting chocolates into advent calendars, or TV presenters first wore sparkly poppies around Remembrance Day instead of normal ones. Yet Athelstan's imperial pretensions and claims in Latin to be totius in charge of everything show confidence and success. England as a place and a kingdom, as a viable state, had finally started to exist. The England that Alfred was deemed by posterity to have reconquered from the Danes didn't really exist before that. It was just a bunch of squabbling Germanic kingdoms. But the claiming of it back had the effect of creating and defining it. As so often in history, what is in fact a novelty is defined and justified in terms of precedent. The House of Wessex claimed to be restoring something, a pre-existing England, which didn't pre-exist, and a pre-existing Romanness, which their regime was absolutely nothing like and had no connection with at all. Five more kings. The four decades after the death of Athelstan in 939 saw the accession of six kings. The next chapter is about the sixth of them, and I'm going to rattle through the first five now. It may well be that after this, no one ever mentions them to you again. The first two, Edmund and Eadred, were Athelstan's half-brothers, sons of Edward the Elder by his third wife, Eadifu. Then there were Edmund's two sons, Eadwy and Edgar. Edgar was known as the Peaceful, which makes him sound nicer than he was. Then, finally, Edward, the, spoiler alert, martyr. They all died young. None of them reached 35, and two of them died in their teens. As I've said, the Kingdom of England existed by this point, but they hadn't done the extension. There was still a viable Danish Kingdom of York when Athelstan died, which had a revival under Edmund and Eadred, and had to be repeatedly pushed back, but was finally knocked on the head in 954. During the troubled and fractious reign of the teenage Eadwy, there was such a split at court in favour of his younger brother Edgar that in 957 the country was briefly partitioned between the two of them, along the line of the Thames, with Eadwy ruling Wessex and Edgar Mercia and Northumbria. This awkward state of affairs ended 2 years later with Eadwy's timely, and very possibly actively timed, death. Edgar the Peaceful is the most significant of these kings. He was a great enthusiast for the monastic reform movement, which was a big deal at the time, exceptionally dull though it sounds. Spearheaded by St Dunstan, Archbishop of Canterbury, and St Ethelwold, Bishop of Winchester, the idea was to sort out the rackety old Anglo-Saxon monasteries, also known as minsters, and make them conform to the rule of St Benedict. This rule was written by an Italian monk called Benedict in the early 6th century and is, in fact, lots of rules. The big ideas were obedience, humility, work and prayer. In contrast, Anglo-Saxon monasteries were often more casual and public-facing than we imagine such institutions to be. Many of the people who lived in them, known as secular clerks, were free to marry and popped in and out, treating the place like a vaguely God-themed club 18 to 30. The system of parish priests and churches hadn't yet developed, so it made sense to have a version of monasticism that wasn't entirely inward-looking. Still, there was an aura of flexibility and fun that's always vulnerable in a religious context. Sure enough, Dunstan and Ethelwold, and many other worthies at the time, declared it vital to sort this out. In an era when most people sincerely believed that incurring divine displeasure could result in the ruination of the kingdom by plague or famine or Viking and the damnation of any specific displeasure incurers, this campaign was about more than virtue signalling. People really thought it was important. This seemed to suit Edgar's temperament. He founded or refounded loads of monasteries and was enthused by the new uniformity that was demanded of them. At the same time, under Ethelwold's influence, he was also introducing uniformity into his administration. He standardised the coinage, exported the West Saxon institution of the Shire to the rest of England, where we can still find them. In fact, they've since found their way into Scotland and Wales too. And established Shire and local courts based on hundreds, areas of 100 hides. A hide was the amount of land deemed sufficient to support a family. Many of the familiar trappings of the English state were being put in place. He does not seem to have been a peaceful man at all, despite his moniker, but rather a self-important, ruthless and tyrannical one. His piety was extolled by contemporary churchmen almost to the point of worship. He was described in the charter of the New Minster in Winchester as the Vicar of Christ, which is a bit crawly. Not to be left behind by continental royal fashion, he gave himself a second coronation 13 years into his reign. It was a special imperial one, conducted in Bath with its Roman associations, in the hope of evoking Charlemagne's capital in Aachen and getting the whole Rex Totius Britanniae vibe going again. All in all, he doesn't seem very nice, yet his reign was genuinely peaceful. The bitter truth is that it was peaceful because of his ruthlessness. He was rigorous and predictable. People knew where they stood. In the medieval era, when people's expectations of government were unbelievably low by modern standards, this was as good as it got. All kings did terrible things, but the ones who did so out of weakness, capriciousness, viciousness, favouritism or fear engendered uncertainty that led to violence and chaos. What helped daily life go smoothly was a straightforward, well-organised hard-ass. Edgar's ruthless and violent refusal to be questioned, his indomitable martial spirit, and his readiness to deploy violence engendered peace. Then, aged about 32, he suddenly died. There was a succession crisis, and everything was immediately fucked again. Of Edgar's two sons, one was an illegitimate teenager called Edward, and another a 5 or 6 year old child called Ethelred. On balance, encouraged by St. Dunstan, the leading nobles went with the teenager, but the situation was very unstable and culminated in Edward's murder by supporters of his infant half-brother. It was an inauspicious start to yet another new reign. Chapter 8. King Ethelred the Unready. There's no justice. Alfred's medium-sized achievements, thanks to his canny commissioning of a praise-packed biography, overshadow that of his more successful successors. Worse still, their fame is also dwarfed by that of the incompetent who came after them. King Ethelred, known as Ethelred the Unready. The nickname sums him up, though apparently unready didn't mean what it sounds like it means, but derives from the Old English word meaning badly advised, while the name Ethelred means well advised. It's a joke. Well-advised, the badly advised, and a message to posterity about the limited impact of nominative determinism. He reigned on and off from 978 to 1016, and his hapless reputation as a man utterly unable to deal with the Vikings is projected down the centuries. Not delusional and hubristic, not aggressive and miscalculating, not idiotic, just a prat and a coward who couldn't cope. This image isn't helped by the terrible drawing of him that always gets used. It's from a 12th century chronicle, so the monk who drew it never laid eyes on the man himself. In fact, the monk who drew it shows few signs of having ever laid eyes on a human being of any sort, though the facial expression he gives Ethelred might have inspired cartoonists of later centuries who are trying to capture the essence of someone who's just been viciously bonked on the head. We find Ethelred sitting on his throne with this look of lopsided bafflement. His right hand is grasping what looks like an enormous inflatable green sword. His left scratches his crotch. One leg is slightly raised as if to facilitate a fart. Unready and unwilling. Ethelred's problems were no more of his own making than he was subsequently able to make them of his own solving. What I'm saying is that, like Alfred, he found himself in a shit situation. But unlike Alfred, he couldn't find his way out. Soon after his reign started, and just when everyone thought it was safe to go back in the water, the Vikings started raiding again. These weren't Danes from the northern or eastern parts of England, they were from Scandinavia, as they had been in the nightmarish 9th century. As the reign progressed, it became clear that they weren't random piratical raiders, but were organised by the King of Denmark and Norway, Swain Forkbeard. Forkbeard is Old Danish for fuckface. No, it isn't. This time, there was an unnerving undertone of invasion by a foreign power to the familiar high stress of everything getting smashed or stolen or occupied. Ethelred was an unenthusiastic warrior. He was exceptionally unwilling to lead troops into battle, and I feel a lot of GCSE empathy for that attitude. At the time, though, it wasn't on. It's the equivalent of a modern politician being afraid of public speaking. In refusing that element of the job, Ethelred was about 700 years ahead of his time. In the alternative he found to fighting, he was 100 years behind it. He reverted to the old and unsuccessful Anglo-Saxon Viking repelling technique, paying them to go away. It's what I did when we had mice. Well, I didn't pay the mice, but I wouldn't be amazed to discover that the mice and the mice removers had struck some sort of deal. As with Ethelred and the Vikings, it was very expensive, but I needed the mice to go away and was willing to pay any sum they named that was less than or equal to all the money I had. Ethelred showed a similar dearth of bargaining acumen and exported a lot of silver as a result. That this was possible was a sign of the wealth and functionality of the kingdom he was ruining. England had an extremely sophisticated coin minting infrastructure for the time, which enabled huge numbers of tiny metal portraits of Ethelred, which were even less realistic than the 12th century monk's drawing of him, but not quite as stupid looking, to invade Scandinavia, which perhaps the king considered a sort of pictorial revenge. To be fair, that wasn't Ethelred's only idea. He also ordered the killing of all the Danes in England. It's a very different approach, isn't it? This was the St. Brice's Day Massacre of 1002, and it gives a nasty, spiteful tinge to Ethelred's harmless idiot image. The whole notion of slaughtering people was a lot more acceptable in those days. Nowadays we're really down on it, but they were really down with it. Oh, the power of prepositions. Still, Swain Forkbeard was disinclined to take the proposed genocide of his countrymen on the prongy chin and invaded. Ethelred's third strategy was to try and build an alliance with Normandy, and that led indirectly to the Norman conquest and the final eclipse of the House of Wessex and Anglo-Saxon kingship itself. Goodness, he really is enjoyably unsuccessful. Not that he could have foreseen the consequences of his Norman overtures. He was just trying to find some support against the Danes and stop the Danes unloading all their loot in convenient nearby Norman ports. The Duke of Normandy, Richard II, half-heartedly agreed to discontinue this practice, a promise he intermittently kept, and Ethelred married Richard's sister, Emma of Normandy, to seal the deal. Ethelred's first wife, Elfiefu, had recently died, so in her role as Queen of England, Emma was also given the name Elfiefu. This might have been less confusing for Ethelred, but not for anyone else, then or since. Enchantingly beautiful, though the name Elfiefu obviously is. Emma of Normandy seems to have been an accomplished power broker, and much of what happened between her marriage to Ethelred and the conquest of England by her great-nephew revolved around her. In the intervening 64 years, it was ruled for 33 years by her two husbands, and for 25 years by two of her sons. The husbands were called Ethelred, as discussed, and Canute, and the sons were called Harthacnut and Edward. You might get an inkling of what was going on, ethnically speaking. A flurry of sad ends. Have you noticed how bankrupted former tycoons always end up somewhere opulent? Their troubles tend to play out in mansions, and somehow the electricity and gas have never been cut off. Someone's still servicing the pool, even as the desperate bankrupt paces round it, shouting, "What about the Swiss accounts?" into his mobile. They might get murdered, but the blood always trickles onto something expensive. It's the same with deposed kings. They tend to keep their creature comforts, which, for those of us who aren't kings, might seem like the main reason it's nice to be a king. Tsar Nicholas II and his family were shot in the basement of the nice country house with servants where they were imprisoned, and former King Constantine II of Greece lived peacefully for many years in Hampstead Garden suburb. You might die, but the circumstances usually remain plush. We know from the life of Alfred the Great that this wasn't always the case. He was literally hiding in a marsh. He would have been cold, wet, hungry, and in fear for his life rather than just the last one. People with royal blood never undergo anything that uncomfortable anymore, except at Gordonstone. When did this start to change? It's earlier than you think. Ethelred, for all his incompetence and throne losing, never ended up down and out in the Somerset Levels, legendarily burning cakes. You may have heard that King Alfred